When he was gone, I took my phone out of my pocket. After making sure it wasn't broken, I called Billy. It was all I could think of to do. He answered on the third ring, shouting to be heard over the chanting of Flo Rida. I told him to come outside and bring Ms. Hargensen. I didn't want to involve a teacher, but even with my chimes rung pretty good, I knew that was bound to happen eventually, so it seemed best to do it from the jump. I thought it was the way Mr. Harrigan would have handled it.
"Why, what's up, dude?"
"Some kid beat me up," I said. "I don't think I better go back inside. I don't look so great." He came out 3 minutes later, not only with Ms. Hargensen, but Regina and Margie. My friend stared with dismay at my split lip and bloody nose. My clothes were also speckled with blood, and my shirt, brand new, was torn. "Come with me," Miss Hargensen said. She didn't seem upset by the blood, the bruise on my cheek, or the way my mouth was fattening up. "All of you." "I don't want to go in there," I said, meaning back into the gym annex. "I don't want to get stared at." "Don't blame you," she said. "This way." She led us to an entrance that said staff only, used a key to let us in, and took us to the teacher's room. It wasn't exactly luxurious. I'd seen better furniture out on Harlow lawns when people had yard sales, but there were chairs, and I sat in one. She found a first aid kit and sent Regina into the bathroom to get a cold washcloth to put on my nose, which she said didn't look broken. Regina came back looking impressed. "There's a Veda hand cream in there." "It's mine," Miss Hargensen said. "Have some if you want. Put this on your nose, Craig. Hold it. Who brought you kids?" "Craig's dad," Margie said. She was looking around at this undiscovered country with wide eyes. Since it was clear I wasn't going to die, she was cataloging everything for later discussion with her gal pals. "Call him," Miss Hargensen said. "Give Margie your phone, Craig." Margie called Dad and told him to come pick us up. He said something. Margie listened, then said, "Well, there was a little trouble." Listened some more. "Well..." Billy took the phone.
"He got beat up, but he's okay."
Listened and held out the phone.
"He wants to talk to you."
Of course he did, and after asking if I was all right, he wanted to know who had done it. I said I didn't know, but thought it was a high school kid who might have been trying to crash the dance. "I'm all right, Dad. Let's not make a big deal of this, okay?" He said it was a big deal. I said it wasn't. He said it was. We went around like that. Then he sighed and said he'd be there as fast as he could. I ended the call. Miss Hargensen said, "I'm not supposed to dispense anything for pain. Only the school nurse can do that, and only then with parental permission, but she's not here, so..." She grabbed her purse, which was hanging on a hook with her coat, and peered inside. "Are any of you kids going to tell on me? And maybe cause me to lose my job?" My three friends shook their heads. So did I, but gingerly. Kenny had caught me with a pretty good roundhouse to the left temple. I hoped the bullying bastard had hurt his hand. Miss Hargensen brought out a little bottle of Aleve. "My private stock. Billy, get him some water." Billy brought me a Dixie cup. I swallowed the pill and felt better immediately. Such is the power of suggestion. Especially when the one doing the suggesting is a gorgeous young woman. "You three, make like bees and buzz," Miss Hargensen said. "Billy, go in the gym and tell Mr. Taylor I'll be back in 10 minutes. Girls, go outside and wait for Craig's father. Wave him over to the staff door." They went. Miss Hargensen leaned over me, close enough so I could smell her perfume, which was wonderful. I fell in love with her. I knew it was sappy, but couldn't help it. She held up two fingers. "Please tell me you don't see three or four." "No, just two." "Okay." She straightened up. "Was it Yanko?" "It was, wasn't it?" "No." "Do I look stupid?" "Tell me the truth." How she looked was beautiful, but I could hardly say that. "No, you don't look stupid, but it wasn't Kenny. Which is good, because see, if it was him, I bet he'd get arrested, because he's already expelled, then there'd be a trial and I'd have to go in court and tell how he beat me up. Everyone would know. Think how embarrassing that would be." "And if he beat somebody else up?" I thought of Mr. Harrigan then, channeled him, you could even say. That's their problem. All I care is that he's done with me. She tried to scowl. Her lips curved in a big smile instead, and I fell more in love with her than ever. That's cold. I just want to get along, I said, which was the God's honest truth. You know what, Craig? I think you will. When my dad got there, he looked me over and complimented Ms. Hargensen on her work. I was a prize fight cut man in my last life, she said. That made him laugh. Neither of them suggested a trip to the emergency room, which was a relief. Dad took the four of us home, so we missed the second half of the dance, but none of us minded. Billy, Margie, and Regina had had an experience more interesting than waving their hands in the air to Beyoncé and Jay-Z. As for me, I kept reliving the satisfying shock that had gone up my arm when my fist connected with Kenny Yanko's eye. It was going to leave a splendid shiner, and I wondered how he'd explain it. Duh, I ran into a door, duh, I ran into a wall, duh, I was jerking off and my hand slipped. When we were back at the house, Dad asked me again if I knew who had done it. I said I didn't. Not sure I believe that, son. I said nothing. You just want to let this go? Is that what I'm hearing? I nodded. All right. He sighed. I guess I get it. I was young once myself. That's a thing parents always tell their kids sooner or later, but I doubt if any of them believe it. I believe it, I said, and I did, although it was amusing to visualize my father as a 5'5" shrimp squeak back in the age of landlines. Tell me one thing, at least. Your mother would be mad at me for even asking, but since she's not here. Did you hit him back? Yes, only once, but it was a good one. That made him grin. Okay, but you need to understand that if he comes after you again, it's going to be a police matter. Are we clear? I said we were. Your teacher, I like her, said I should keep you up at least an hour and make sure you don't go all woozy. Want a piece of pie? Sure. Cup of tea to go with it? Absolutely. So we had pie and big mugs of tea, and Dad told me stories that weren't about party telephone lines or going to a one-room school where there was just a wood stove for heat or TVs that only got the three stations and none at all if the wind blew down the roof antenna. He told me about how he and Roy DeWitt found some fireworks in Roy's cellar, and when they shot them off, one went into Frank Driscoll's kindling box and set it on fire. And Frank Driscoll said if they didn't cut him a cord of wood, he'd tell their parents. He told me about how his mother overheard him call old Philly Lubird from Shiloh Church Big Chief Wampum and washed his mouth out with soap, ignoring his promises to never say anything like that again. He told me about fights at the Auburn Rollerdrome, rumbles he called them, where the kids from Lisbon High and those from Edward Little, Dad's school, got into it just about every Friday night. He told me about getting his bathing suit pulled off by a couple of big kids at White's Beach. I walked home with my towel wrapped around me. And the time some kid chased him down Carbine Street in Castle Rock with a baseball bat, he said I put a hickey on his sister, which I never did. He really had been young once. I went upstairs to my room feeling good. But the aleve Ms. Hargensen had given me was wearing off, and by the time I got undressed, the good feeling was wearing off with it. I was pretty sure Kenny Yanko wouldn't come back on me, but not positive. What if his friends started getting on his case about the shiner, teasing him about it, laughing about it even? What if he got pissed and decided round two was in order? If that happened, I would most likely not even get in one good blow. The shot to his eye had been kind of a sucker punch after all. He could put me in the hospital, or worse. I washed my face, very gently, brushed my teeth, got into bed, turned off the light, and then just lay there, reliving what had happened. The shock of being grabbed from behind and shoved down the hallway. Being punched in the chest. Being punched in the mouth. Telling my legs to hold me up and my legs saying, maybe later. Once I was in the dark, it seemed more and more likely that Kenny wasn't done with me.
Logical, even. The way things lots crazier than that can seem logical when it's dark and you're alone. So I turned on the light again and called Mr. Harrigan. I never expected to hear his voice. I only wanted to pretend I was talking to him. What I expected was silence, or a recorded message telling me the number I'd called was no longer in service. I'd slipped his phone into the pocket of his burial suit 3 months previous, and those first iPhones had a battery life of only 250 hours, even in standby mode, which meant that phone had to be as dead as he was. But it rang. It had no business ringing. Reality was totally against the idea, but beneath the ground of Elm Cemetery, 3 miles away, Tammy Wynette was singing Stand By Your Man. Halfway through the fifth ring, his slightly scratchy old man's voice was in my ear. The same as always, straight to business, not even inviting his caller to leave a number or a message. I'm not answering my phone now. I will call you back if it seems appropriate. The beep came, and I heard myself talking. I don't remember thinking about the words. My mouth seemed to be operating completely on its own. I got beat up tonight, Mr. Harrigan, by a big stupid kid named Kenny Yanko. He wanted me to shine his shoes, and I wouldn't. I didn't snitch on him because I thought that would end it. I was trying to think like you, but I'm still worried. I wish I could talk to you. I paused. I'm glad your phone is still working, even though I don't know how it can be. I paused. I miss you. Goodbye. I ended the call. I looked in recents to make sure I had called. His number was there, along with the time, 11:02 p.m. I turned off my phone and put it on the night table. I turned off my lamp and was asleep almost at once. That was on a Friday night. The next night, or maybe early on Sunday morning, Kenny Yanko died. He hung himself, although I didn't know that, or any of the details, for another year. The obituary for Kenneth James Yanko wasn't in the Lewiston Sun until Tuesday, and all it said was, passed away suddenly as the result of a tragic accident. But the news was all over the school on Monday, and of course the rumor mill was in full operation. He was huffing glue and died of a stroke. He was cleaning one of his daddy's shotguns. Mr. Yanko was said to have a regular arsenal in his house, and it went off. He was playing Russian roulette with one of his daddy's pistols and blew his head off. He got drunk, fell down the stairs, and broke his neck. None of these stories was true. Billy Bogan was the one who told me as soon as he got on the short bus. He was all but bursting with the news. He said one of his ma's friends from Gates Falls had called and told her. The friend lived across the street and had seen the body coming out on a stretcher with a passel of Yankos surrounding it, crying and screaming. Even expelled bullies had people who loved them, it seemed. As a Bible reader, I could even imagine them rending their clothes. I thought immediately, and guiltily, of the call I'd made to Mr. Harrigan's phone. I told myself he was dead and couldn't have had anything to do with it. I told myself that even if stuff like that were possible outside of comic book horror stories, I hadn't specifically wished Kenny dead. I just wanted to be left alone. But that seemed somehow lawyerly. And I kept remembering something Mrs. Grogan had said the day after the funeral when I called Mr. Harrigan a good guy for putting us in his will. Not so sure about that. He was square dealing, all right, but you didn't want to be on his bad side. Dusty Bilodeau had gotten on Mr. Harrigan's bad side, and surely Kenny Yanko would have been too, for beating me up when I wouldn't shine his fucking boots. Only Mr. Harrigan no longer had a bad side. I kept telling myself that. Dead people don't have bad sides. Of course, phones that haven't been charged for 3 months can't ring and then play messages or take them either. But Mr. Harrigan's had rung, and I had heard his rusty old man's voice, so I felt guilty. But I also felt relieved. Kenny Yanko would never come back on me. He was out of my road. Later that day, during my free period, Ms. Hargensen came down to the gym where I was shooting baskets, and took me into the hall. "You were moping in class today," she said. "No, I wasn't."
"You were,
and I know why. But I'm going to tell you something. Kids your age have a Ptolemaic view of the universe. I'm young enough to remember. I don't know what."
Ptolemy was a Roman mathematician and astrologer who believed the Earth was the center of the universe, a still point everything else revolved around. Children believe their entire worlds revolve around them. That sense of being at the center of everything usually starts to fade by the time you're 20 or so, but you're a long way from that. She was leaning close to me, very serious, and she had the most beautiful green eyes. Also, the smell of her perfume was making me a little dizzy.
"I can see you're not following me, so let me dispense with the metaphor. If you're thinking you had something to do with the Yanko boy's death, forget it. You didn't. I've seen his records, and he was a kid with serious problems. Home problems, school problems, psychological problems. I don't know what happened, and I don't want to know, but I see a blessing here."
"What?" I asked. "That he can't beat me up anymore?" She laughed, exposing teeth as pretty as the rest of her. "There's that Ptolemaic view of the world again."
"No, Craig. The blessing is that he was too young to get a license. If he'd been old enough to drive, he might have taken some other kids with him. Now go back to gym and shoot some baskets." I started away, but she grabbed my wrist. 11 years later, I can still remember the electricity I felt.
"Craig, I could never be glad when a child dies, not even a bad actor like Kenneth Yanko. But I can be glad it wasn't you."
Suddenly I wanted to tell her everything, and I might have done it, but just then the bell rang, classroom doors opened, and the hall was full of chattering kids. Ms. Hargensen went her way, and I went mine. That night, I turned on my phone, and at first just stared at it, gathering my courage. What Ms. Hargensen had said that morning made sense, but Ms. Hargensen didn't know that Mr. Harrigan's phone still worked, which was impossible. I hadn't had a chance to tell her, and believed, erroneously as it turned out, that I never would. "It won't work this time," I told myself. "It had one last spurt of energy, that's all, like a light bulb that flashes bright just before burning out." I hid his contact, expecting, hoping, actually, for silence or a message telling me the phone was no longer in service, but it rang, and after a few more rings, Mr. Harrigan was once more in my ear.
"I'm not answering my phone now. I will call you back if it seems appropriate."
"It's Craig, Mr. Harrigan." Feeling foolish, talking to a dead man, one who would be growing mold on his cheeks by now. I had done my research, you see. At the same time, not feeling foolish at all, feeling scared like someone treading on unhallowed ground.
"Listen." I licked my lips. "You didn't have anything to do with Kenny Yanko dying, did you? If you did, knock on the wall." I ended the call. I waited for a knock. None came. The next morning, I had a message from Pirate King 1. Just 6 letters. Small A, small A, small A. Capital C, X. Meaningless. It scared the hell out of me.
That autumn, I thought a lot about Kenny Yanko. The current story making the rounds was that he had fallen from the second floor of his house while trying to sneak out in the middle of the night. I thought even more about Mr. Harrigan and about his phone, which I now wish I'd thrown into Castle Lake. There was a fascination, okay? The fascination with strange things we all feel. Forbidden things. On several occasions, I almost called Mr. Harrigan's phone, but I never did. At least, not then. Once I'd found his voice reassuring, the voice of experience and success, the voice you could say of the grandfather I'd never had. Now I couldn't remember that voice as it had been on our sunny afternoons, talking about Charles Dickens or Frank Norris or D.H. Lawrence or how the internet was like a broken water main. Now all I could think of was the old man rasp, like sandpaper that's almost worn out, telling me he would call me back if it seemed appropriate. And I thought of him in his coffin. The mortician from Hay and Peabody had no doubt gummed down his eyelids, but how long did that gum last? Were his eyes open down there? Were they staring up into the dark as they rotted in their sockets? These things preyed on my mind. A week before Christmas, Reverend Mooney asked me to come into the vestry so we could have a chat. He did most of the chatting. My father was worried about me, he said. I was losing weight, and my grades had slipped. Was there anything I wanted to tell him? I thought it over and decided there might be. Not everything, but some of it. If I tell you something, can it stay between us? As long as it doesn't have to do with self-harm or a crime, a serious crime, the answer is yes. I'm not a priest, and this isn't the Catholic confessional, but most men of faith are good at keeping secrets. So I told him that I'd had a fight with a boy from school, a bigger boy named Kenny Yanko, and he'd beat me up pretty good. I said I never wished Kenny dead, and I'd certainly not prayed for it, but he had died almost right after our fight, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. I told him what Ms. Hargensen had said about how kids believed everything had to do with them and how it wasn't true. I said that helped a little, but I still thought I might have played a part in Kenny's death. The Rev smiled.
Your teacher was right, Craig. Until I was 8, I avoided stepping on sidewalk cracks so I wouldn't inadvertently break my mother's back.
Seriously?
Seriously.
He leaned forward. His smile went away.
I will keep your confidence if you will keep mine. Do you agree?
Sure.
I'm good friends with Father Ingersoll of St. Anne's in Gates Falls. That is the church the Yankos attend. He told me that the Yanko boy committed suicide.
I think I gasped. Suicide had been one of the rumors going around in the week after Kenny died, but I had never believed it. I would have said the thought of killing himself had never crossed the bullying son of a bitch's mind. Reverend Mooney was still leaning forward. He took one of my hands in both of his.
Craig, do you really believe that boy went home, thought to himself, oh my goodness, I beat up a kid younger and smaller than me. I guess I'll kill myself.
I guess not, I said. And I let out a breath it felt like I'd been holding for 2 months. When you put it like that, how did he do it?
I didn't ask, and I wouldn't tell you even if Pat Ingersoll had told me. You need to let this go, Craig. The boy had problems. His need to beat you up was only one symptom of those problems. You had nothing to do with it.
And if I'm relieved that, you know, I won't have to worry about him anymore?
I'd say that was you being human.
Thanks.
Do you feel better?
Yes. And I did.
Not long before the end of school, Ms. Hargensen stood before our earth science class with a big smile on her face.
You guys probably thought you were going to be rid of me in 2 weeks, but I have some bad news. Mr. DeLesseps, the high school biology teacher, is retiring, and I've been hired to take his place. You could say I'm graduating from middle school to high school. A few kids groaned theatrically, but most of us applauded, and no one clapped harder than I did. I would not be leaving my love behind. To my adolescent mind, it seemed like fate, and in a way, it was. I also left Gates Falls Middle behind and started the 9th grade at Gates Falls High. That was where I met Mike Uberoth, known then, as he is in his current career as a backup catcher for the Baltimore Orioles, as U-Boat.
Jocks and more scholarly types don't mix much at Gates. I imagine it's true at most high schools because jocks tend to be clannish. And if it hadn't been for arsenic and old lace, I doubt if we ever would have become friends. U-Boat was a junior, and I was just a lowly freshman, which made becoming friends even more unlikely. But we did, and we remain friends to this day, although I see him far less often. Many high schools have a senior play, but that wasn't the case at Gates. We had two plays each year, and although they were put on by the drama club, all students could audition. I knew the story because I'd seen the movie version on TV one rainy Saturday afternoon. I enjoyed it, so I tried out. Mike's girlfriend, a drama club member, talked him into trying out, and he ended up playing the homicidal Jonathan Brewster. I was cast as his scurrying sidekick, Dr. Einstein. That part was played by Peter Lorre in the film, and I tried my best to sound like him, snaring, "Yes, yes," before every line. It wasn't a very good imitation, but I have to tell you that the audience ate it up. Small towns, you know. So that's how U-Boat and I became friends, and it's also how I found out what had really happened to Kenny Yanko. The Rev turned out to be wrong, and the newspaper obituary turned out to be right. It really had been an accident. During the break between Act 1 and Act 2 of our dress rehearsal, I was at the Coke machine, which had eaten up my 75 cents without giving me anything in return. U-Boat left his girlfriend, came over, and gave the machine's upper right corner a hard whack with the palm of one hand. A can of Coke promptly fell into the retrieval tray. "Thanks," I said.
"No prob. You just have to remember to hit it right there, in that corner."
I said I would do that, although I doubted I could hit it with the same force.
"Hey, listen. I heard you had some trouble with a Yanko kid, true?"
There was no sense denying it. Billy and both girls had blabbed, and really no reason to at this late date. So I said, yeah, it was true.
"You want to know how he died?"
"I've heard about 100 different stories. Have you got another one?"
"I've got the truth, little buddy.
You know who my dad is, don't you?"
"Sure."
The Gates Falls police force consisted of fewer than 2 dozen uniformed officers, the chief of police and one detective. That was Mike's father, George Uberoth.
"I'll tell you about Yanko if you let me hit your soda."
"Okay, but don't backwash."
"Do I look like an animal?"
"Give it to me, you fucking cheesecake."
"Yes, yes," I said, doing Peter Lorre.
He snickered, took the can, downed half of it, then belched. Down the hall, his girlfriend stuck a finger in her mouth and mimed puking. Love in high school is very sophisticated.
"My dad was the one who investigated," U-Boat said, handing the can back to me. "And a couple of days after it happened, I heard him talking to Sergeant Polk from the house. That's what they call the cop shop. They were out on the porch drinking beers, and the Sarge said something about Yanko doing the chokey-strokey. Dad laughed and said he'd heard it called a Beverly Hills necktie. The Sarge said it was probably the only way the poor kid could get off with a pizza face like that. My dad goes, yeah, sad but true. Then he said what bothered him was the hair. Said it bothered the coroner, too."
"What about his hair?" I asked. "And what's a Beverly Hills necktie?"
"I looked it up on my phone. It's slang for auto-erotic asphyxiation."
He said the words carefully, with pride almost.
"You hang yourself and beat off while you're passing out."
He saw my expression and shrugged.
"I don't make the news, Dr. Einstein. I just report it. I guess it's supposed to be an extremely big thrill, but I think I'll pass."
I thought I would, too.
"What about the hair?"
I asked my dad about that. He didn't want to tell me, but since I'd heard the rest, he eventually did. He said half of Yanko's hair had turned white. I thought about that a lot. On the one hand, if I had ever considered the idea of Mr. Harrigan rising from his grave to extract vengeance on my behalf, and sometimes at night when I couldn't sleep, the idea, however ridiculous, would creep into my mind. U-Boat's story seemed to put paid to those thoughts. Thinking about Kenny Yanko in his closet,
pants around his ankles and a rope around his neck, face turning purple as he did the old choky-strokey, I could actually feel sorry for him. What a stupid, undignified way to die. As the result of a tragic accident, the Sun obituary had said, and that was more accurate than any of us kids could have known. But on the other hand, it was that thing U-Boat's dad had said about Kinney's hair. I couldn't help wondering what might cause such a thing to happen. What Kinney might have seen in that closet with him as he swam toward unconsciousness while pulling his poor old pudding for everything he was worth. Finally, I went to my best counselor, the Internet. There, I found a difference of opinion. Some scientists proclaimed that there was absolutely no evidence that shock can turn someone's hair white. Other scientists said, yes, yes, it really could happen. That a sudden shock could kill the melanocyte stem cells that determine hair color. One article I read said that actually happened to Thomas More and Marie Antoinette before they were executed. Another article threw shade on that, saying it was just a legend. In the end, it was like something Mr. Harrigan sometimes said about buying stocks. You pays your money, and you takes your choice. Little by little, these questions and concerns faded. But I'd be lying if I told you that Kinney Yanko ever completely left my mind, then or now. Kinney Yanko in his closet with a rope around his neck. Maybe not losing consciousness before he could loosen the rope, after all. Kinney Yanko, perhaps seeing something, only perhaps, that had frightened him so badly that he had fainted. That he had actually been scared to death. In daylight, that seemed pretty stupid. At night, especially if the wind was high and making little screaming sounds around the eaves, not so much. A for sale sign from a Portland realty company went up in front of Mr. Harrigan's house, and a few people came up to look at it. They were mostly the kind who fly in from Boston or New York, some of them on charter jets, probably. The kind who, like the business folks who had attended Mr. Harrigan's funeral, pay extra to rent expensive cars. One pair was my first married gay couple, young but clearly well-to-do and just as clearly in love. They came in a snazzy BMW i8, held hands everywhere they went, and did a lot of wow and amazing over the grounds. Then they went away and didn't come back. I saw a lot of these potential buyers because the estate, managed by Mr. Rafferty, of course, had kept Mrs. Grogan and Pete Bostwick on, and Pete hired me to help out with the grounds. He knew I was good with plants and was willing to work hard. I got $12 an hour for 10 hours a week, and with the big trust fund out of reach until I was in college, that money came in very handy. Pete called the potential buyers Richie Riches. Like the married couple in their rented BMW, they went wow, but didn't buy. Considering the house was on a dirt road and the views were only good, not great, no lakes, no mountains, no rock-bound seacoast with a lighthouse, I wasn't surprised. Neither were Pete or Mrs. Grogan. They nicknamed the house White Elephant Manor. In the early winter of 2011, I used some of my gardening money to upgrade my first-generation phone to an iPhone 4. I swapped in my contacts that same night, and when I scrolled through them, I came across Mr. Harrigan's number. Without thinking too much about it, I tapped it. "Calling Mr. Harrigan," the screen said. I put the phone to my ear with a combination of dread and curiosity. There was no outgoing message from Mr. Harrigan. There was no robot voice telling me the number I'd called was no longer in service. And there was no ring. There was nothing but smooth silence. You could say my new phone was, as quiet as the grave. It was a relief. I took biology my sophomore year, and there was Ms. Hargensen, as pretty as ever, but no longer my love. I had switched my affections to a more available and age-appropriate young lady. Wendy Gerard was a petite blonde from Motton who had just gotten rid of her braces.
Soon we were studying together and going to movies together, when either my dad or her mom or dad would take us, that was, and making out in the back row. All that sticky kid stuff that's so absolutely fine. My crush on Ms. Hargensen died a natural death, and that was a good thing because it opened the way for friendship. I brought plants into class sometimes, and I helped out cleaning the lab, which we shared with the chem kids after school on Friday afternoons. On one of those afternoons, I asked her if she believed in ghosts. "I suppose you don't, being a scientist and all," I said. She laughed. "I'm a teacher, not a scientist. You know what I mean." "I suppose, but I'm still a good Catholic. That means I believe in God and the angels and the world of the spirit. Not so sure about exorcism and demonic possession. That seems pretty far out there. But ghosts? Let's just say the jury's out on that one. I'd certainly never attend a seance or mess around with a Ouija board." "Why not?" We were cleaning the sinks, something the Kim kids were supposed to take care of before they left for the weekend but hardly ever did. Ms. Hargensen paused, smiling, maybe a little embarrassed. "Science folks aren't immune from superstition, Craig. I don't believe in messing with what I don't understand. My grandmother used to say, a person shouldn't call out unless they want an answer. I've always thought that was good advice. Why do you ask?" I wasn't going to tell her Kinney was still on my mind. "I'm a Methodist myself, and we talk about the Holy Spirit. Only in the King James Bible, it's the Holy Ghost. I guess I was thinking about that." "Well, if ghosts exist," she said, "I'll bet not all of them are holy." I still wanted to be some kind of writer, although my ambition to write movies had cooled. Mr. Harrigan's joke about the screenwriter and the starlet recurred to me every now and then and had cast a bit of a pall over my showbiz fantasies. For Christmas that year, Dad got me a laptop, and I started to write short stories. They were okay line by line, but the lines of a story have to add up to a whole, and mine didn't. The following year, the head of the English department tapped me to edit the school paper, and I got the journalism bug, which has so far never left me. I don't think it ever will. I believe you hear a click, not in your head, but in your soul, when you find the place where you belong. You can ignore it, but really, why would you? I started getting my growth. And when I was a junior, after I had shown Wendy that yes, I had protection, it was U-Boat who actually bought the condoms, we left our virginity behind. I graduated third in my class, only 142, but still, and Dad bought me a Toyota Corolla, used, but still. I got accepted at Emerson, one of the best schools in the country for aspiring journalists, and I bet they would have given me at least a partial scholarship, but thanks to Mr. Harrigan, I didn't need it. Lucky me. There were a few typical adolescent storms between 14 and 18, but actually not that many. It was as if the nightmare with Kinney Yanko had in some way front-loaded a lot of my adolescent angst. Also, you know, I loved my dad, and it was just the two of us. I think that makes a difference. By the time I started college, I hardly ever thought of Kinney Yanko at all. But I still thought of Mr. Harrigan. Not surprising, considering that he had rolled out the academic red carpet for me. But there were certain days when I thought of him more often. If I was home on one of those days, I put flowers on his grave. If I wasn't, Pete Bostwick or Mrs. Grogan did it for me. Valentine's, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and my birthday. I always bought a dollar scratch ticket on those days, too. Sometimes I won a couple of bucks, sometimes five, and once I won 50, but I never hit anything close to a jackpot. That was okay with me. If I had, I would have given the money to some charity. I bought the tickets to remember. Thanks to him, I was already rich. Because Mr. Rafferty was generous with the trust fund,
I had my own apartment by the time I was a junior at Emerson. Just a couple of rooms and a bathroom, but it was in Back Bay, where even small apartments aren't cheap. By then, I was working on the literary magazine. Plowshares is one of the best in the country, and it always has a hotshot editor, but someone has to read the slush pile, and that was me. I liked the job, even though many of the submissions were on a par with a memorably, even classically bad poem called 10 Reasons Why I Hate My Mother. It cheered me up to see how many strivers out there were worse at writing than I was. Probably that sounds mean. Probably it is. I was doing this chore one evening with a plate of Oreos by my left hand and a cup of tea by my right when my phone buzzed. It was Dad. He said he had some bad news and told me Miss Hargensen had died. For a moment or two, I couldn't speak. The stack of slush pile poems and stories suddenly seemed very unimportant. "Craig," Dad asked, "are you still there?" "Yes." "What happened?" He told me what he knew, and I found out more a couple of days later, when the Gates Falls Weekly Enterprise was published online. "Beloved teachers killed in Vermont," the headline read. Victoria Hargensen Corliss had still been teaching biology at Gates. Her husband was a math teacher at neighboring Castle Rock. They had decided to spend their spring vacation on a motorcycle trip across New England, staying at a different bed and breakfast every night. They were on their way back, in Vermont, and almost to the New Hampshire border, when Dean Whitmore, 31, of Waltham, Massachusetts, crossed the Route 2 center line and struck them head-on. Ted Corliss was killed instantly. Victoria Corliss, the woman who had taken me into the teacher's room after Kenny Yanko beat me up and gave me an illicit leave from her purse, had died on the way to the hospital. I'd interned at the Enterprise the previous summer, mostly emptying the trash but also writing some sports and movie reviews. When I called Dave Gardner, the editor, he gave me some background the Enterprise hadn't printed. Dean Whitmore had been arrested a total of 4 times for OUI, but his father was a big hedge fund guy. How Mr. Harrigan had hated those upstarts, and high-priced lawyers had taken care of Whitmore the first 3 times. On the 4th occasion, after running into the side of a Zoni's Go-Mart in Hingham, he had avoided jail but lost his license. He'd been driving without one and operating under the influence when he struck the Corliss motorcycle. "Stone drunk," was the way Dave put it.
"He'll get off with just a slap on the wrist," Dave said. "Daddy will see to it. You watch and see."
No way. Just the idea of that happening made me feel sick to my stomach. "If your info is correct, it's a clear case of vehicular homicide."
"Watch and see," he repeated.
The funerals were at St. Anne's, the church both Ms. Hargensen, it was impossible for me to think of her as Victoria, and her husband had attended for most of their lives, and the one they had been married out of. Mr. Harrigan had been rich, for years a mover and shaker in the American business world. But there were a lot more people at the funeral of Ted and Victoria Corliss. St. Anne's is a big church, but that day it was standing room only, and if Father Ingersoll hadn't had a microphone, he would have been inaudible beneath all the weeping. They had both been popular teachers. They were a love match, and of course, they had been young. So were most of the mourners. I was there. Regina and Margie were there. Billy Bogan was there. So was U-Boat, who'd made a special trip from Florida where he was playing single-A ball. U-Boat and I sat together. He didn't cry exactly, but his eyes were red, and the big galoot was sniffling. "Did you ever have her for class?" I whispered. "Bio too," he whispered back. "When I was a senior. Needed it to graduate. She gave me a gift C. And I was in her bird-watching club.
She wrote me a recommendation on my college app.
She had written me one, too.
It's just so wrong,
U-Boat said.
They weren't doing nothing but taking a ride.
He paused.
And they were wearing helmets, too.
Billy looked about the same, but Margie and Regina looked older, almost adult in their makeup and big girl dresses. They hugged me outside the church when it was over, and Regina said, "Remember how she took care of you the night you got beat up?" "Yes," I said. "She let me use her hand cream," Regina said, and began to cry all over again.
"I hope they put that guy away forever," Margie said fiercely.
"Roger that," U-Boat said. "Lock him up and throw away the key." "They will," I said. But of course, I was wrong, and Dave was right. Dean Whitmore's day in court came that July. He was given 4 years, sentence suspended if he agreed to go into a rehab and could pass random urine tests for those same 4 years. I was working for the Enterprise again, and as a paid employee, only part-time but still, I'd been bumped up to community affairs and the occasional feature story. The day after Whitmore's sentencing, if you could even call it that, I voiced my outrage to Dave Gardner.
"I know, it sucks," he said. "But you gotta grow up, Craigie. We live in the real world, where money talks and people listen. Money changed hands in the Whitmore case somewhere along the line. You can count on it. Now aren't you supposed to be giving me 400 words on the craft fair?"
A rehab, possibly one with tennis courts and a putting green, wasn't enough. 4 years of piss testing wasn't enough, especially when you could pay someone to provide clean samples if you knew ahead of time when the tests were going to come. Whitmore probably would. As that August burned away, I sometimes thought of an African proverb I'd read in one of my classes. When an old man dies, a library burns. Victoria and Ted hadn't been old, but somehow that was worse, because any potential they might have had was never going to be realized. All those kids at the funeral, both current students and recent graduates like me and my friends, suggested that something had burned and could never be rebuilt. I remembered her drawings of leaves and tree branches on the blackboard. Beautiful things done freehand. I remembered us cleaning the bio lab on Friday afternoons, then doing the chem half of the lab for good measure, both of us laughing about the stink, her wondering if some Dr. Jekyll chemistry student was going to turn into Mr. Hyde and go rampaging through the halls. I thought of her saying, "Don't blame you," when I told her I didn't want to go back into the gym after Kenny beat me up. I thought of those things and the smell of her perfume. And then I thought of the asshole who'd killed her, graduating from rehab and going about his business, happy as a Sunday in Paris. No, it wasn't enough. I went home that afternoon and dug through the drawers of the bureau in my room, not quite admitting to myself what I was looking for or why. What I was looking for wasn't there, which was both a disappointment and a relief. I started to leave, then went back and stood on tiptoe to explore the top shelf in my closet, where junk had a way of accumulating. I found an old alarm clock, an iPod that had busted when I dropped it in the driveway while skateboarding, a tangle of earphones and earbuds. There was a box of baseball cards and a stack of Spider-Man comic books. At the very back, there was a Red Sox sweatshirt much too small for the body I now inhabited. I lifted it, and there, underneath, was the iPhone my father had given me for Christmas, back in my shrimp squeak days. The charger was there, too. I plugged the old phone in, still not quite admitting what I was up to, but when I think of that day now, not so many years ago, I believe that the motivating force was something Ms. Hargensen had said to me while we were cleaning the chem lab sinks. A person
shouldn't call out unless they want an answer. That day, I wanted one. It probably won't even take a charge, I told myself. Been up there gathering dust for years. But it did. When I picked it up that night, after Dad had turned in, I saw a full battery icon in the upper right-hand corner. Man, talk about your trips down memory lane. I saw emails from long ago, photos of my dad from before his hair started to go gray, and IMs back and forth between me and Billy Bogan. No news in them, really, just jokes and illuminating information like, I just farted, and incisive questions like, did you do your algebra? We'd been like a couple of kids with Del Monte cans connected by a length of waxed string, which is what most of our modern communications amount to when you stop to think of it. Chatter for the sake of chatter. I took the phone to bed with me, just as I had back before I needed to shave and when kissing Regina was a huge deal. Only now, the bed which had once seemed big seemed almost too small. I looked across the room at the poster of Katy Perry I'd put up when she had seemed, to junior high school me, the epitome of sexy fun. I was older than that shrimp squeak kid now, and I was just the same. Funny how that works. If ghosts exist, Ms. Hargensen had said, I'll bet not all of them are holy. Thinking of that almost made me stop. Then once more, thinking of that irresponsible asshole playing tennis in his rehab, I went ahead and called Mr. Harrigan's number. It's okay, I told myself. Nothing will happen. Nothing can happen. This is just a way of clearing your mental decks so you can leave the anger and sorrow behind and move on to the next thing. Except part of me knew something would happen, so I wasn't surprised when I got a ring instead of silence. Nor was I when his rusty voice spoke in my ear, originating from the telephone I'd put in his dead man's pocket almost 7 years before.
I'm not answering my phone now. I will call you back if it seems appropriate.
Hello, Mr. Harrigan. It's Craig. My voice was remarkably steady, considering that I was talking to a corpse, and the corpse might actually be listening. There's a man named Dean Whitmore who killed my favorite teacher from high school and her husband. The guy was drunk and hit them with his car. They were good people. She helped me when I needed help, and he didn't get what he deserved. I guess that's all. Except it wasn't. I had at least 30 seconds or so to leave a message, and I hadn't used them all. So I said the rest of it, the truth of it, my voice dropping lower still, so it was almost a growl. I wish he was dead. These days, I work for the Times Union, a newspaper that serves Albany and the surrounding area. The salary is peanuts. I could probably make more writing for BuzzFeed or TMZ, but I have that trust fund as a cushion, and I like working for an actual paper, even though most of the action these days is online. Call me old-fashioned. I made friends with Frank Jefferson, the paper's go-to IT guy, and one night over beer at the Madison Poor House, I told him I'd once been able to connect with the voicemail of a guy who was dead, but only if I called from the old phone I'd had when the guy was still alive. I asked Frank if he'd ever heard of anything like that. No, he said, but it could happen. How? No idea, but there were all sorts of weird glitches with the early computers and cell phones. Some of them are legendary.
iPhones, too?
Especially them, he said, swigging his beer, because they were rushed into production. Steve Jobs never would have admitted it, but the Apple guys were scared to death that in another couple of years, maybe only one, BlackBerry would achieve total market dominance. Those first iPhones, some of them locked up every time you typed the letter L. You could send an email and then surf the web, but if you tried to surf the web and then send an email, your phone sometimes crashed.
That actually happened to me once or twice, I said,
I had to reboot.
Yeah, there was all kinds of stuff like that. Your thing? I'd guess the guy's message somehow got stuck in the software. Same way you can get a piece of gristle stuck between your teeth. Call it the ghost in the machine.
Yes, I said, but not a holy one.
Huh?
Nothing, I said. Dean Whitmore died on his second day in the Raven Mountain Treatment Center, a luxury spin-dry facility in upstate New Hampshire. There were indeed tennis courts, also shuffleboard, and a swimming pool. I knew almost as soon as it happened, because I had a Google alert on his name, both on my laptop and my weekly enterprise computer. No cause of death was given. Money talks, you know. So I took a little trip to the neighboring New Hampshire town of Maidstone. There I put on my reporter's hat, asked a few questions, and parted with some of Mr. Harrigan's money. It didn't take long, because as suicides went, Whitmore's was more than a bit out of the ordinary. Kind of like strangling to death while beating off is out of the ordinary, you could say. At Raven Mountain, the inpatients were called guests instead of dopers and alkies, and each guest room had its own shower. Dean Whitmore went into his before breakfast and chugged down some shampoo. Not to commit suicide, it seemed, but to grease the runway. He then broke a bar of soap in two, dropped half on the floor, and crammed the other half down his throat. I got most of this from one of the counselors, whose job at Raven Mountain was to work at breaking drunks and druggies of their bad habits. This fellow, Randy Squires by name, sat in my Toyota, drinking from the neck of a wild turkey bottle purchased with some of the $50 I'd given him, and yes, the irony was not lost on me. I asked if Whitmore had perhaps left a suicide note.
He did, Squires said. Kind of sweet, actually. Almost a prayer. Keep giving all the love you can, it said.
My arms broke out in goose flesh, but my sleeves covered that, and I was able to manage a smile. I could have told him that wasn't a prayer, but a line from Stand By Your Man by Tammy Wynette. Squires wouldn't have gotten it anyway, and there was no reason why I'd want him to. It was between Mr. Harrigan and me. I spent 3 days on that little investigation. When I got back, Dad asked me if I'd enjoyed my mini-vacation. I said I had. He asked me if I was ready to go back to school in a couple of weeks. I said I was. He looked me over carefully and asked if anything was wrong. I said there wasn't, not knowing if that was a lie or not. Part of me still believed that Kenny Yanko had died accidentally, and that Dean Whitmore had committed suicide, possibly out of guilt. I tried to imagine how Mr. Harrigan could have somehow appeared to them and caused their deaths, and couldn't do it. If that had happened, then I was an accessory to murder, morally, if not legally. I had wished Whitmore dead, after all. Probably, in my deepest heart, Kenny too.
You sure?
Dad asked. His eyes were still on me, and in the old searching way I remembered from early childhood, when I'd done some small thing wrong. Positive, I said.
Okay, but if you want to talk, I'm here.
Yes, and thank God he was. But this wasn't a thing I could talk about, not without sounding like a lunatic. I went into my room and took the old iPhone off the closet shelf. It was holding its charge admirably. Why exactly did I do that? Did I mean to call him in his grave to say thank you? To ask him if he was really there? I can't remember, and I guess it doesn't matter, because I didn't call. When I powered up the phone, I saw I had a text message from Pirate King 1. I tapped with a trembling finger to open it and read this. Capital C. Capital C. Capital C. Small s. Capital T. As I looked at it, a possibility
that had never so much as touched my mind before that late summer day dawned on me. What if I were somehow holding Mr. Harrigan hostage, tying him to my earthly concerns by way of the phone I had tucked into his coat pocket before the lid of his coffin went down? What if the things I had asked him to do were hurting him, maybe even torturing him? Not likely, I thought. Remember what Mrs. Grogan told you about Dusty Bilodeau. She said he couldn't have gotten a job shoveling hen shit out of old Dorrance Marsteller's barn after stealing from Mr. Harrigan. He saw to it. Yes, and something else. She said he was a square-dealing man, but if you weren't the same, God help you. And had Dean Whitmore been square-dealing? No. Had Kenny Yanko been square-dealing? The same. So maybe Mr. Harrigan had been glad to pitch in. Maybe he even enjoyed it. If he was ever there at all, I whispered. He had been. In my deepest heart, I knew that, too. And I knew something else. I knew what that message meant. Craig, stop. Because I was hurting him? Or because I was hurting myself? I decided that in the end, it didn't matter. It rained hard the next day, the kind of chilly, no-thunder downpour that means the first autumn color will begin to show in a week or two. The rain was good, because it meant that the summer people, those who remained, were all tucked up inside their seasonal hideaways, and Castle Lake was deserted. I parked in the picnic area at the lake's north end and walked to what we kids had called the ledges, standing there in our bathing suits and daring each other to jump off. Some of us even did. I went to the lip of the drop where the pine needles gave out and the bare rock, which is New England's ultimate truth, began. I reached into the right pocket of my khakis and brought out my iPhone 1. I held it in my hand for a moment, feeling its weight and remembering how delighted I'd been on that Christmas morning when I unwrapped the box and saw the Apple logo. Had I screamed for joy? I couldn't remember, but almost certainly. It was still holding its charge, although it was down to 50%. I called Mr. Harrigan, and in the dark earth of Elm Cemetery, in the pocket of an expensive suit coat now speckled with mold, I know Tammy Wynette was singing. I listened to his scratchy old man's voice one more time, telling me he would call back if it seemed appropriate. I waited for the beep. I said, "Thank you for everything, Mr. Harrigan. Goodbye." I ended the call, cocked my arm back, and threw the phone as hard as I could. I watched it arc through the gray sky. I watched the small splash as it hit the water. I reached into my left-hand pocket and brought out my current iPhone, the 5C, with its colorful case. I meant to throw it into the lake as well. Surely I could make do with a landline, and surely it would make my life easier. So much less chitter-chatter. No more texts reading, "What are you doing?" No more dumb emojis. If I got a job on a newspaper after I graduated and needed to keep in touch, I could use a loaner, then give it back when whatever assignment had necessitated it was finished. I cocked my arm back, held it that way for what felt like a long time. Maybe a minute, maybe two. In the end, I put the phone back in my pocket. I don't know for sure if everyone is addicted to those high-tech Del Monte cans, but I know that I am, and I know Mr. Harrigan was. It's why I slipped it into his pocket that day. In the 21st century, I think our phones are how we are wedded to the world. If so, it's probably a bad marriage. Or maybe not. After what happened to Yanko and Whitmore, and after that last text message from Pirate King One, there are a great many things I'm not sure of. Reality itself, for a start. I do know two things, however, and they are as solid as New England rock. I don't want to be cremated when I go, and I want to be buried with empty pockets.